Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I have a new website. It is called simonbowne.com. That's Bowne, not Brown. It replaces the Past Lives Hypnosis website, and you can go to that website, The Past Life Progression, as well as info on my books and podcasts. This week, I'm talking to Samantha Caulfield about her book, Create Your Own Afterlife, Take Control of Life After Death. As a Mambo, teacher, writer, and spiritual counsellor, Mambo Sam has spent over 25 years helping others navigate the mysteries of love, healing, justice, and spirit communication. Hi, Samantha. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. How are you this evening?
I'm fine, thanks. And we're going to talk about your book. It's called Create Your Own Afterlife, Take Control of Life After Death.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about your life, you know, when you were younger, first of all.
Sure.
Was it that you were a Catholic?
Yeah, that's true. I still sort of am. Whether they would claim me or not, I'm not sure, but at this point. So I grew up a Catholic, and I think my problems, as with a lot of people with most religions, is I really view the religion in a very passionate and beloved way. And when I get into the politics of the religion, that sort of falls apart for me. So I try to look at it more as the ritual of the religion, as your connection to spirit, as opposed to your connection to the humans that are fallible and can make mistakes and all of those things. So I tend to just try to concentrate on the heart of it, although I do like the new Pope, so I'm okay with that. But anyway, so I did grow up a Catholic. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and so very, very Catholic prevalent. And I went to Catholic school for 6 years before I went over to public school. And during that time, and this is really kind of one of the interesting things about the books. I feel like this, unbeknownst to me, I feel like this book has been in the works a good part of my life. Because, and you think about this, this is true with a lot of religions. You're already sort of training to, quote unquote, create your own afterlife. Because you're already being taught, if you are good, you will get a reward. And if you are bad, you will get a punishment. So by being good in that reward and punishment is different throughout different religions. You know, we could say heaven and hell, you know, just for the listener, you know, it's more conceptual to speak of it that way. But I kind of like to just think of it as reward and punishment. So we're already planning. We're already taught to plan. So we're taught to be good. Will get the reward. Now, in my case, of course, I believed that the reward would be heaven. And I had this very limited, well, I was a child, very limited view of the idea that it would be me and Jesus, and we would sit on a cloud. Now, I can't tell you how many times I visualized that as a child. And I would be willing to bet a lot of people in their childhood had some visualization of both what that reward might be and what that punishment might be. And so here we're even already as children visualizing our afterlife and expecting that what we do here on earth will impact what we do when we're no longer on this earth. So as a very young child, I was already in the planning stage. I was like, oh, absolutely. This is the thing. Obviously, as I grew older, I began to not question the reward and punishment yet. I hadn't questioned that yet. But I started to really question whether or not Jesus was going to have time to sit with me on the cloud. And if he was going to sit with me on the cloud, like, what are the other people going to do? Is he just going to be on the cloud for me? So, you know, about the fifth, sixth grade, I kind of started to try to start broadening those horizons kind of thing. But when you think about it, that is really where the book started. I'm being taught as a child that I can have impact on my afterlife. And a lot of times when I explain it like that to people, they're like, oh, because they don't really see it that way, that they're already planning it. They're already trying to control it. And literally, we are taught in most religious and spiritual practices that we are in control. That's what they're telling us. We don't take it that way. As children, we generally don't take it that way, that we're the ones in control. But that's what they're telling us. Be good, reward. Be bad, punishment. So this little seed for this book, I feel like was planted long, long ago, to show us that we have agency over this afterlife, even though we're not being taught that.
And even though you're a Catholic when you were young, mm-hmm. I think you said by the age of 18, you'd been initiated as a witch.
I had been initiated as a witch. So when I was 18, New Orleans was, and I'm 72 now, so you do that math. So anyway, when I was 18, which is 1971, New Orleans was really having things like witchcraft and voodoo and seances and all of those things were becoming more and more public because somewhere along the line, in New Orleans, they figured out what a huge tourist attraction that was. And so once they figured that out, you know, a shop started. There were always little shops in the French Quarter in New Orleans. You know, there were always like little tea rooms. As a matter of fact, my own mother read tea leaves at a very famous tea room there called Bottom of the Cup, which, if I'm not mistaken, I believe is still there. So the people came into town and, you know, it was like a little bit bad, a little bit exciting, because, you know, if you come from somewhere else, not quite as exciting as a place like New Orleans, you probably don't have a witchcraft shop there. You know, you probably don't have card readers and tea leaf readers and all of that. So things really took a big boom in the late 60s, early 70s. And I was dating a man who would go on to be my first husband, who's passed away. I was dating a man who was older than me and was already into the high magic and the, you know, the like serious stuff. Well, of course, I'm 18. I'm like, whoa, let's do this thing. So I did get initiated, which I'm so happy for, because the lady that I was initiated with, Oneida Toops, was just a wonderful person. She's long since passed away, but she's very famous, you know, in the witch world. And so Oneida, people kind of juxtapose those two names. But anyway, so I'm really, really glad that I was able to do that, because it has gone on in reputation to become one of those things that's considered real and considered authentic. And so I just feel so blessed that that happened. And that also my mother, who, that's a complicated relationship, but one thing my mother did not do was try to, when I was younger, we'll kind of move back there for a second, she never tried to squelch down the idea of things that are unknown, the paranormal things. I told her, I was out playing in my backyard one time, and I saw a leprechaun, and I mean, just broad daylight. And I saw him for like a full 30 seconds, and he looked like a movie leprechaun, just like, you know, if you would conjure that image up in your head, that's what the leprechaun looked like. And I kind of blinked my eyes and I didn't see him anymore. Being the ever popular and wonderful child that I was, I immediately ran over to see if he left a pot of gold. He did not. But darn it. But I ran in and told my mom. I was like, I saw a leprechaun in the backyard. And she said, come show me where. And we ran out the back door and I showed her right where. And we looked all around to see if we could see, you know, where the grass had been moved or anything. So she really fostered that in me. And that is one thing I will always be thankful for is, you know, she never said, oh, that's just your imagination, or don't tell tales, don't tell lies, which in speaking over the last 30 some odd years, counseling clients and everything, the vast majority of them actually had that kind of squelch down in them. Don't talk about that. Don't say dead grandpa came and sat on the edge of your bed. That's in your imagination. Don't say those things. You know, so those gifts tend to be shut off in children, and mine weren't. So that leading kind of back to the whole background and feeling, you know, comfortable in writing this book, same thing. It was never toned down in me, partially because of where I lived and partially because of my mom and just the way she just accepted everything.
Yeah, because you say in the book that you've been communicating with ghosts since you were about 10 years old.
Yes.
So what kind of experiences did you have?
Oof, man, we need another podcast for that song. We need the ghost one. So many, many, many things. And it's kind of funny, when I was the first time I can remember anything, I'm going to say I was maybe four or five. And I saw a woman in our kitchen, and we were renting this place while we were waiting for our house to be built. So we rented this place, and it was old New Orleans style home. And I saw this woman in our kitchen cooking and, you know, doing all the things. And I did not know who she was. So my mom was out back hanging laundry on the line, if anybody remembers what that was like. Anyway, she was out back hanging laundry on the line and said, Mom, who is that woman cooking in the kitchen? And she's like, well, what woman? I'm like, there's a redheaded woman cooking in the kitchen. My mom's like, okay. She put her laundry down, came to the kitchen, nobody there. Now I no longer saw the woman. And I was like, oh, she was here. And I'm little. I remember the ghost herself more than I remember the events surrounding it. But I do remember this. And if anybody's out there listening, you have children that have these gifts and you don't really want to squelch them down, try this instead. My mom told me this. She said, okay, she's not here right now, but tell me everything you remember about her. And I did. And what happened with that is, to this day, I remember her. I remember what she looks like. She had shocking red hair. She was pretty young. I mean, of course, then I'm sure I thought she was old, but I mean, she was probably 30 at the most. Very pretty. She had this sunflower apron on. I could see her. I don't want to say she was completely corporeal, because I've only seen one ghost that was completely corporeal, and that was recent. But it's like she was translucent almost. But at the time, I thought she was a real person. It didn't dawn on me as a baby that I wasn't seeing a real person. Now when I think about it, when I close my eyes and see it, I'm like, oh, of course, she's not fully there. But she was there enough that I could remember all of the details of her. Here's the kicker to this one, though. So my mom's like, well, she's not here now, and, you know, so forth and so on. And my mom said, do you know what she was cooking? And I was like, I think she was making soup. Because it was a big pot, and I remember stirring it. So soup, remember, I'm five. Okay. So long story short, my father at that time owned a small restaurant, and sometimes he, instead of us cooking, he would bring us some meals from there. So he called my mom to tell her, don't cook. We had like a lot of leftovers from the special, and I'm going to bring that home. We'll have that for dinner. So my dad comes home a couple of hours later, and he steps in the door, and daddy. And he looks around and he says, wait, I thought I told you not to cook. And my mom said, I didn't cook. He said, well, I smell gumbo cooking. Neither my mom or myself smelled anything. When my dad walked in, he literally smelled gumbo cooking. So that's proof enough for me, although at five, I didn't know that was proof, but it's just such a story that resonates with me now, the fact that, and my dad was a very practical man. I'm not saying he wasn't a believer, but he was pragmatic. He was practical. He never tried to shut anything down, but I was like, Daddy, a ghost was cooking in the kitchen. He was like, oh, that's nice, honey. And that was the end of that. Isn't that fascinating that he could smell that when he came home?
It's that one of those things that you hear about visits from like deceased loved ones, that there might be a smell around.
Yeah. And you know, once I got much, much older, I was like, I wonder if she died in that house, or was she just happily in that house because she had lived there? And you know, maybe sometimes she just liked to visit. So, you know, because she certainly didn't look in distress. And when I went back to that story years later, when I started having more encounters and learning about other people's encounters, I tried to sort of tap into that energy and see, was she distressed? Did she not want to be there or anything like that? But I did not pick up anything like that. It was, in a way, a very mundane encounter, a lady cooking in her kitchen, but no stress or anything like that. So, you know, which is something I go over in the book. Not every ghost is stuck. Not every ghost needs help. Not every ghost wants to move somewhere else. And I kind of feel like she corroborated that for me at a very young age, because no sense of stress at all.
So the book's called Create Your Own Afterlife. Yes. So can you give us a brief overview about the book? How is it structured?
So I like to tell a little story, and it's in the book, about what the motivation was to finally write all this down. And that is my dear friend, Mariana, who we had been friends for many, many years, and I was her spiritual guider and her mentor and all these things. We'd probably known each other, 25 years at that point. And one day she called me and she told me she had stage 4 ovarian cancer. Oh, well, that was just, you know, that proverbial kick in the gut with her cancer. And as we talked about it, she knew she was going to die from it. And I knew it too. I was like, I'm sorry, honey, you're just not going to beat this. And so the one thing that she wanted to know from me was, what is going to happen next? What am I going to see? What am I going to do? And we talked a lot about it, and I didn't feel like I could hit on anything that seemed quite satisfactory. We both, of course, together had occult beliefs and different spiritual beliefs and things like that. But nothing quite hit me. I never felt like I was giving her the answer that she needed. And so one day we were talking on the phone, and I just need to know what is going to happen. And I was like, Mariana, what do you want to happen? And I said it a little emphatically like that, and sort of, and you know, I'm a good Southern girl. So, you know, we don't challenge people like that. And so the minute I said it, and I know this is happening to everyone, you just want to shove those words right back into your mouth. You're like, oh my goodness, how could I have said that to her? She's sick. But before I could apologize and say, I had no right to answer that. She started out with a litany of things that she wanted to see, wanted to do, wanted to be. I said, start writing this down. And she did. And from then until 2 days before she died, that's what we talked about. You know, who she would be, who she would see. She had led kind of a sheltered life. She was introverted. She wanted a life where she had more friends, where she would meet more people. And she wanted to know all her animals were going to be there because she had left the Catholic Church because the Pope at that time had said animals don't have souls. And that girl walked out of the Catholic Church that day and never went back. And so that's how powerful her belief was in seeing those companions again, because they had been her friends that she didn't have as very many as humans. And so we started talking about that, you know, okay, where are we going to be? What are we going to do? And what adventures are we going to have? And that's when everything kind of started to click into place. What adventures are we going to have in the afterlife? So this wonderful woman, probably from the time that she was diagnosed, well, from the time we had our epiphany, until a couple of days before she died, she had written about 100 pages of what she wanted to do. And when I went to see her for the last time, she handed them to me and said, hey, just keep these for me, okay? And I said, oh, I will. And I'll keep reading them so that I'll be there too. And we'll get this plan locked down. And that was the last time I saw her. So that's the true heart of this book. Literally me asking someone, well, what do you want to happen? In a frustrated way, even. But it also, it took many years later to write the book, but it was always in the back of my head, and I was going to make it a workbook and different things. And then when wonderful Llewellyn Worldwide picked up the book, that's how we kind of got to the structure that we're at today. But I'm sorry, I'm rattling on. Did you want to say something else?
I wanted to go through the different parts in the book. Yes. A little bit. You say you will be choosing who you want to be with in the afterlife. So I suppose do you sit down and write out a list? Right, I want to see these people, but Absolutely. Also a list of, I don't want to see these people.
Absolutely. Because I hate to say it, but sometimes that list is the first list people write. And it kind of, they're like, oh no. You've gonna mess up my life. You're not gonna come mess up my afterlife. No way. And you know, so right, for sure. And so yes, that's one of the things we do. And I had an interesting question. I did a presentation at the Llewellyn Con that they just wrapped up. And one of the comments, one of the people said, I don't want to see anyone from this life again. And I wish someone would address that. And I said, that is literally what this book is about. It is about your autonomy. It's about your agency over your afterlife. What do you, she wants to see her animals and, you know, have different adventures. And I was like, that is addressed in the book. And that's sort of, she really sort of rang home the book itself, because you don't have to do, this is not Samantha Corfield tells you what you have to do in the afterlife. This is Samantha Corfield helps you decide and manifest and plan what you're going to do in the afterlife. And so, yes, definitely. And there's lots of exercises in the book to help you, because, you know, sometimes you sit down and you want to write something down, but, you know, you maybe feel less than inspired or whatever. And so we had a lot of meditations, and I have a lot of journal prompts. And one of the first things in there is to decide who that first person is. Before we even get into a long list, decide who that first person is. And if it's not a person, it's an animal, decide who that is. If it's neither, if it's a place, decide where that is. And write that down. And I encourage people, and there's lots of examples, I encourage people to write this down in detail, this first thing. Write down in detail, like, for instance, I want to see my dad first. And so I've a detailed account of that in the book, of what will happen, how it will happen, where I will see him, what it feels like, what it smells like, what it looks like, every little detail that your senses have, to take that and put that into that first important meeting, whatever it means to you. And so I feel like this sets the basis up for the rest of the book, because now you kind of have that referential point where you go, yes, okay, that's where it starts. And then everything else sort of branches off from there. But yes, and it definitely leads you through the people that you want to see, you don't want to see. And also, maybe you don't know them. Maybe you want to, and like I said, I'm not here to tell anybody what to do with this book. Maybe, you know, maybe you don't even know the person. If you had a secret crush for 25 years, you know, remains of the day kind of thing. And that's what you want. That's perfect, because it's perfect for you. And, you know, and nobody gets to tell you what to do. And that's my favorite thing about this book and this system. No one gets to tell you what to do. You get to tell you what to do. And so, yes, that's where we start. We kind of get that, you know.
So what if you've been married more than once and you prefer to see your first spouse and not your second one?
Hey.
But they're in their plan. The one you don't want to see does want to see you. So does that disrupt your plan or their plan?
No, because, well, and if they're following the plan in this book, and I can only speak of if they're following this, there's a lot in the book about free will. And free will remains intact. And I'm always kind of amazed when people think, oh, my free will doesn't go away when I die. I'm like, well, why would it? You had it before you were born, and you had it here, and your spirit is just pure energy, and you can't destroy that. And so your free will and their free will is going to remain intact. And so we always have the ability to say no if we're in someone else's plan. Like I said, if they're using this, and I think that pretty much we can always say no anyway. Of course, I haven't been there. I can't quite prove it, but just kind of going on the premise of the whole honoring of free will, I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I have a first husband that has passed away. I loved him dearly. And now I have a husband again. And what did I do? I chose to see my dad first. So it's like, okay, whatever. You know, so. And I think that it's fine to choose the order in which you want to see people and have that experience with them. I just don't think that a lot of the pettiness that, I'm not saying not wanting to see your ex is petty. I don't mean that, because gotcha. But, you know, I think a lot of the pettiness that kind of rules our lives, and the hatred, and things like that. I even go over in the book how to try to drop some of that before you go cross over, because you don't want to take that with you. But it's also ridiculous to think you're going to drop everything. You're not. I have things that I've worked on for years. I'm like, okay, well, that's not going away. Cool. I guess I'll just be dragging that to the afterlife. But as much as we can, I have a section about, let's try to work through some of that. Let's try to kind of compartmentalize and pack that away before we pass away. The bonus part of that is it makes for a better living life as well. You know, so a lot of people do some of the exercises and ideas that I have for getting through things like anger and guilt and, you know, all of that. And they're like, oh, that helped me now. Which is also sort of the point. We want you to have an amazing life as much as possible, as long as possible, and then have your amazing afterlife. But yeah, I feel like, and sometimes the next question in that is about reincarnation. And I certainly, if that's your belief system, not going to step on that. And I do believe, however, it was just kind of funny. I've sort of always believed you could choose your reincarnation. And so if that's in a person's belief system or spiritual practice or religion, and you're expecting that to happen, I believe you can take some control over that, which again, they are already teaching you that you can, you know, be a good person, you will have a good reincarnation. Be a bad person, you'll probably have a bad reincarnation. So we're already taking control of these things. Now we're just upping it to a level to where not only we're just going to have good or bad, we're going to have the details that go with good.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. Have you ever felt a pull toward a place, a person, or a pattern in your life that you just can't explain? Past life regression can be a deeply healing and insightful experience, helping you explore the stories, emotions, and connections that may be shaping who you are today. Whether you're seeking clarity, emotional release, or a deeper understanding of your soul's journey, a session can open the door to powerful personal insight. To find out more, or to book a session, visit simonbound.com. Hello, Simon here. So we can have a list of the reunions, but you say you can also have other beings on there, like you can have your pets on the list, or even Greek gods and mythical creatures and fictional beings or aliens. And so could you say, I'd like to meet James Bond when I'm there?
Yeah, I know it sounds crazy. And I'm well aware that, you know, some of the chapters, people might be rolling their eyes. But think about this. You can imagine that right now. Simon can close his eyes. He can picture whichever James Bond is the best one, Sean Connery. And you can picture that in your head. If you sit long enough, you could sit there and have a conversation in your head. You could reach your hand out. You could probably shake his hand, and it would become very real to you. It's the same thing. And so I had someone ask me, well, are we just making make-believe? And I was like, what if we are? If we're experiencing it, there you are. You're having that experience that you wanted to have. And also, kind of, since you mentioned the aliens, I would love to talk to you about aliens sometime. Anyway, so with the talking about the aliens, the people wanting to be like, I want that. I want to have that experience of what that would be like to go to another planet. And, you know, not be like in the movies, always everybody's always had to take over Earth. I'm like, maybe it comes with something good, you know? But I was like, oh, I want to feel that experience of what does that feel like to go to an unknown planet and you're the alien, and what's that experience for you? So, you know, I kind of make a little joke in the book that might as well call it afterlife vacation planning, because, you know, those things that you plan for vacation are very often one-time dreams that you had, and you're going to do it that time, and you probably won't have, maybe you might not have a chance to do it again. And I kind of look at those scenarios in that same way. That is that amazing thing. You know, like I have in my plan that I want to be a greeter for homeless animals that pass away, and to find them the lonely people that need a companion, and to put them together. Does it sound like a flight of fancy? Maybe. But you know what, Simon? I can feel it. I sit long enough with that, I can feel it happening. And my grandma always taught me thoughts are things. And so I've adhered by that and try to be careful about what I think. But I believe that I will have that experience. And, you know, people say sometimes, well, Sam, what if you're wrong? I'm like, well, what if I'm right? It's not hurting. It's not hurting anything to plan now, is it? No. So, yeah. And it's so interesting to me. I'm sorry, I know I get off topic, but it's so interesting to me how many people have told me what peace this planning brings them. It kind of brings us into the grief end of things, but we'll talk about that when you're ready. But yeah, I think that you can't get too fanciful. And this is something that some of my more practical friends have had kind of a hard time wrapping their head around, and they're kind of just coming around to it now after reading the book of it's not Earth anymore. It's the universe now, and you're in it. And that means you can be anything, I think. You know, so, and there's, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, we don't have to get too much into, but, you know, things about universal laws and right and wrong and things like that. And, you know, I do tell people, I do think that the whole cosmic consciousness that we're all a part of, I wouldn't plan too many terrible things in my afterlife that I want to do, because I feel like you put your own light out and then none of this is going to matter. And so exciting, yes. Adventure, yes. Naughty, sure. Go ahead and be naughty. You know, all of those things. But, you know, I always tell people, I don't really recommend, I can't tell you what to do, obviously, but don't recommend taking this to a dark side, because I feel like that's when you end up extinguishing your own light, and poof, I feel like then you can be gone.
So can you, like, choose the body you'll have? Like, if you die when you're 60, you think, oh, I want the body I had when I was 25. But then it goes further than that. Could you say, hey, you know what? I'd rather be Brad Pitt. I'd rather have his body. Or somebody who's like, I'd rather be Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, God, I hope so. Yeah, I've had body struggles, let's just say. And I'm already 72, so God knows how old I'll be. So I don't want to be that frail, you know, little frail grandma up there. But yes, and that is also because you're not taking a body with you. So there we are. Some people have told me, I just want to be light. I just want to be light, just shooting around the universe. And I'm like, yeah, you can be that, because you don't, this body is fragile. This body will fail us. We're not taking this sucker with us. We're burying it, burning it, dropping it in the ocean. Whatever we're doing with it, it's not going with us. We are, my grandma used to say that you will finally be free when you die. You will be free of this shell that will eventually just crumble away. So sure, you can manifest that reality for yourself to look the way you want to do. Funny thing, I've had a lot of people, it's just like you said though, Simon, not necessarily looking to be Brad Pitt, but, you know, looking to be 25-year-old me, and have that vitality and, you know, looks and, you know, body, all the things to put you into that mindset. Now, I've had some readings in the past. I've done some readings in the past in books where, there are some beliefs that that happens automatically, that you are returned to a vibrant state and that you don't really even have to ask for it. So that's a belief system in and of itself. But absolutely, this creaky old body is not going with me. And I will be ushering in 18-year-old me.
There's a section that says, do you want to continue to be you as you are in this lifetime? And so is that to do with your personality and that side of things?
Yes, but it's also this, because and sometimes, of course, unfortunately, people know that they're getting ready to die and maybe have a year to live or 6 months or whatever, and they're going to miss things. And so what they would like to do is experience those things on the other side. And that I feel like is so important that, you know, I like Mariana, she was, I think, just 50 when she passed away. I think it was 50. And, you know, she could have lived a lot longer and traveled and, you know, lots of different things. And those were earthly things. And of course, you can keep your personality and all that, which without getting into a big esoteric thing, you're going to keep that anyway. So, you know, if she had put in there that she wanted to go see Paris and, you know, there were earthly things she wanted to continue to do. I have a gentleman who, he has a slow growing cancer, so he's probably going to live about 5 more years. But after that, it's not long enough for him to see grandchildren, interact with his grandchildren, and he wants to experience all of that from the other side. So that's perfectly wonderful to have that plan, that you want to experience those things and continue at least part of your earthly life, or maybe that's all you want. Like I said, there's no, you know, there's no wrong answers as to what you want to see, do, and be in your afterlife. So, I think that is, there's things also, I'm like, you know, I'm getting older now. I may see a great-grandchild or not. I have grown grandchildren, but they don't seem to be procreating anytime soon. So I'm like, I would love to see my great-grandchildren if they're not here by the time, you know, I pass. So yeah, I think that a lot of people are going to want to hang on to some of these earthly things. And, you know, I feel like that's perfectly normal.
And I see in the book you say you don't have to deserve a beautiful afterlife to create one.
Right. And that's where people get really tripped up. As a matter of fact, I have a very dear client who did a very bad thing. And he really falls into the good people do bad things sometimes category. And he perfectly thinks that he should be punished. And if hell is his punishment, that, you know, that's, you know, what he thinks. He does not think that he deserves any reward or anything. And this is, I have a section in there about dealing with your guilt and doing the best you can to alleviate some of that guilt. And I have strategies in there for what people can do about it. And I've encouraged him to do that. And he has served time. He paid his debt to society. And I'm like, you have to, because he's acknowledged and has been repentant in his own heart, not to some church, but he's been repentant in his own heart and tried to make all the amends he can, and he's still not believing he deserves the reward of a good afterlife. And I really do beg to differ. I mean, excuse me, if you've been a jerk your entire life and, you know, you've been doing multiple horrible things, well, no, you probably don't deserve it, but you can probably still get it. But what, in cases like this, there's so many people that think that the things that they've done wrong have simply taken them out of the running for that eventual reward that we're taught about and has put them squarely in the middle of the punishment. So, interesting thing with this man, he said, no, I really think I deserve punishment in the afterlife. And I said, do you think you deserve it for eternity? And he's like, well, maybe not eternity. And I said, well, if you absolutely have to, if you feel like you absolutely must, whatever that punishment you think it is you should suffer, put that in your afterlife plan and put a time limit on it. And if you think that that is the thing that is going to make you feel better, and eternity being a very long time, if you can spend enough time in whatever you think the punishment should be, and then B, be freed from that, then plan after that the more wonderful things. Because I know everybody has an opinion on this, but in my opinion, I'm like, well, you know you did wrong. You've tried to make amends. You've served your time. You've accepted your punishment. What else can you do? I mean, you can't undo what you did. But as a human spirit, that's really all the alternatives you have. And once that is done, I think you do deserve, you know, that happiness in that afterlife. And like I said, it might be a controversial opinion, but it's mine, so I'm sticking to it.
And can planning your own afterlife also help you with grief for somebody that's already passed on?
Oh, yes. And even though I did not technically write this as a grief book, I am really recommending it to, and I've been trying to send it to people who are grieving. You know, you see people on the internet that these horrific things happen to them. I've been trying to get in touch with some people and actually just send them the book. Like, you don't have to buy the book, but like send it to them, because I really want them to have it. Because it's mentioned in the book, and I've mentioned it before. When I was in the final edit of this book, my 21-year-old grandson died under some tragic circumstances. And I was in the middle of this edit, and I just, of course, you know, went down that grief rabbit hole that is there. And I thought, oh my God. And even my wonderful folks at Llewellyn were like, we could push back your release date. Like, do you need a couple of months or 3 months or 6 months? And I was like, no, I'm going to use this book to help me. And the power from creating the things. So his name was Preston, and he and I had some pretty specific plans for things that we were going to do. And a lot of it was travel, and there's stories in the book about it. Anyway. Of course, when he died, as when any loved one dies, the hope of doing those things that you planned to do, wanted to do, or expected to do, that hope is gone, extinguished. That light is out. And that is one of the absolute worst parts of losing someone, is that they don't carry, you carry on and they don't. So I started writing down the things that he and I had planned, a trip to China. It's a long story. It's in the book about why it's China. But anyway, I started planning those things. I started writing those down, and I will have that experience with him. And I think that that is one of the biggest gifts that this book can give you if you are grieving someone, to relight your hope. You know, because everybody that, you know, is, you know, I ask them, like, you know, well, what do you want when you die? I want to be reunited with my husband. I want to be reunited with my son, or whomever it is. And, you know, my question to them is always, and then what? You get your reunion. Now what? What you guys doing? And people kind of light up when I say that. They're like, oh, wait a minute. And I was like, it makes sense, though, to you, right? And they're like, it does. Because now, even though you're just, you know, grief is, you know, it's a powerful, powerful, powerful monster. And but we can tame that monster a bit by taking some of the power away that exists when you think you have no more future with that loved one. Because indeed you do. And you can plan it. And I even, like, now I talk to Preston when I'm doing things, and I, you know, I try to engage him in the planning, you know, to be like, yes, we're going to do that, or, you know, that kind of thing. So if you are grieving, I strongly recommend you get this book. It also, and I know sometimes people, especially people who have lost someone, that money is, you know, money's gone. This book has been released into libraries. So you can actually, I'm pretty sure if you go to your local library and ask them to get it, I feel pretty sure that they would, because a lot of libraries already have it. So if that's the way you get your hands on this book, then get your hands on this book this way. Because I know maybe $20 doesn't seem like a lot of money, but sometimes that's a lot of money to people. And so I just highly encourage anyone that's going through this hopelessness of grief, get this book, read it, get your hope back. Are you still going to be grieving? Sadly, yes. But you will have some hope back then. And to me, that has just been so important. And some of my close folks that were also in grief over different things, or in actually losing Preston, they've just been like, oh, I can still plan. And I'm like, yes, still plan. Go read the things. And again, broaden your horizons away from the fact that we're being good and we're going to heaven or Valhalla or wherever we're going. Try to get past that initial thought to what do you do next once you're there. And I'm telling you, it has been a potent grief help. A lot of people, I did a podcast with a wonderful lady, Selena, and she had lost someone, and the book just really helped her reconcile a lot of the things. So I strongly recommend it if you're grieving. Get your hands on it however you can.
Now, you say in the book you've had two near-death experiences. Could you tell us about those?
Oh, absolutely. I actually wrote a whole article on them. If you go, my website for the book is createyourownafterlife.com. And I'm uploading some of the articles that I've written so you can read it, because, you know, time limits here. But anyway, so the first one, my cousins and I, I'm from New Orleans, and my mother had taken me to visit her sister and my cousins in Virginia. And so we're at Virginia Beach, and we're out on a raft, my two cousins and myself, the three of us. We're on a raft, and we're just having a day, right? And a big wave came and pulled us under, knocked us off the raft, pulled us under. So I went under, and I never fought. I didn't try to save myself, because I started seeing the most magnificent things under the water. And I was like, 10, 12, I can't even remember. Anyway, old enough to have seen enough movies and picture books and films where you'd have the beautiful coral reefs and mermaids and, you know, the real things and the fantastical things kind of all melded together for me. I saw a crystal cave, and I was like, oh, I just have to go explore that crystal cave and see what's in there. And so I started propelling myself toward that. And the thing that I remember the most, Simon, is the colors were out of this world, literally. And if I close my eyes, I can still see it. And I've never really seen anything like it since. It's hard to explain, you know, when like pink is so pink that you never saw that pink before, kind of thing. And so I started toward the crystal cave. And the next thing is I woke up on the beach. And I thought I was under, at the time I was experiencing this, it seemed like, I don't know, hours. It seemed like a long time. And next thing is I woke up on the beach getting CPR and spitting water out and hearing my mother screaming, my cousins crying, and my uncle, God bless his soul. My uncle Lenny, who had been in the Navy and was a strong swimmer and all the things, had pulled me out. And I woke up, and for a brief second, I was slightly disappointed, because I really wanted to see that. And I wanted to go to that cave. And the thing about that cave was I inherently knew something in there was for me and me alone.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called Create Your Own Afterlife, Take Control of Life After Death. And people can get that in a lot of places, can't they?
Yeah, and all the booksellers, Amazon. If you have local bookstores and they're carrying it, please support your local bookstores. And if you would, I always try to remind people, not just for me, but for other authors you like, go leave a review, please, because it's an author's lifeblood. And so all those people that you love, that you read their books, go jump on Goodreads or Barnes & Noble or Amazon, whatever, and leave a review for them. But yeah, it's almost anywhere. And you can get it directly from me as well at createyourownafterlife.com.
And is there other things you do for people?
Yes. I am also initiated in Haitian Vodou, and I am a counselor and practitioner. And I'll just throw a little plug in there. That is bellmaker.com, and that's my other life. But the two lives go together.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon, for having me. I so hope we get to talk again. I'm dying to talk about aliens. So think about me, okay?
Okay. This week, I was talking to Samantha Caulfield about her book, Create Your Own Afterlife, Take Control of Life After Death. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you'll get access to the extended episodes. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. And if you enjoy the episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.